Welcome to Divergent Paths with Dan Dunford. My name is Dan Dunford, and today has been a day. It's been a weird week. You know, some really high highs and some really low lows. I don't usually do long intros. I usually get in and get out, introduce the guest, and then get into the interview, but you know, I don't know if that's an option today. I don't think I've ever on one of these podcasts, this is what, episode 44, I think, and I've ever, for every week I've done it, I've never really weighed in on anything that wasn't specifically related to my podcast. But this time I'm going to. And obviously I'm recording this right after midnight on Sunday. And, you know, is there really the need for another person to talk about the horrible, horrible, heartbreaking events that took place in Orlando earlier today? You know, probably not. You know, there's been piece after piece written on it by far more educated and informed and people than I am, and people who are better at writing than I am, and throughout this week on television shows and on podcasts, there'll be a lot of people talking about it, and maybe those people are better at it than I am. It's just, I gotta say something, because you know, if you have a forum, why not use it? I don't know. A lot of people have been expressing the fact that they're just at a loss of what to say, what to do. And I'm not the kind of person who ever really writes about stuff on social media. And I think that's kind of what gets on me the most, is this terrible thing happened. And, you know, this is, I'm not the first person to observe this, but everyone seems to rush to social media immediately. And there's all these people saying thoughts and prayers, which, you know, that's great. If you have your beliefs to, you know, pray if that you think that will do something or what, you know, I have no issues with that. But people have been started poking holes in that, though, you know, thoughts and prayers, the hypocrisy of only saying thoughts and prayers. And now that's kind of become the new hip thing to do, is to be the person over here being like, oh, well, thoughts and prayers mean, you know, that's such an easy thing to say. That basically means nothing. Especially when it's coming from politicians who are supported by the gun lobby, which that's a whole other can of worms that I probably shouldn't get into. But you know, so it's, you know, fighting back and forth on social media and on television about who looks the best, you know, in responding to a terrible tragedy. I haven't even mentioned this, and a lot of people aren't mentioning it, but a tragedy that was inflicted on a group of people who have been historically marginalized and terrorized in this country. I mean, it's like, lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, queer, like, you know, that group has dealt with it so much as it is, and now this. It's horrifying. I would just encourage people, if you're listening to this, you know, if you haven't skipped over it, I will, you know, and if you don't want to listen to this, fine, I will put a chapter marking in the episode notes, so you can just skip right to the interview if you want. I would encourage people to donate to causes that are actively involved in helping those affected by this tragedy. Don't just sit on social media, and you can change your profile picture and stick a banner on it and say, oh, I support these people, and you can post thoughts and prayers all you want, but even if you're just helping one person, that's worthwhile. If you can make a difference in one person's life by giving just a few dollars, or I don't know, there's, like I said, I'm at a loss just like anyone else. I'm trying to figure out myself what I can do, from my little apartment in New York. So anyway, there are several places that I've seen, where they have set up places to give. I'm not trying to make my, I personally made a few small donations earlier today. There's one GoFundMe that's been going around. It's easy to find on Google, and I'll pull a link on it, but there's a GoFundMe that is specifically for the victims of the families of the victims of the shooting. But also, I found, some people were sharing this around on Twitter. The center, orlando.org, is a website you can go to. It's a community center for the LGBT community in Orlando. It's one of the oldest in the country. You can donate to them personally. They provide counseling and resources to the LGBTQ community in Orlando. As I'm seeing now, they also have set up a separate GoFundMe for victims of, families of victims and victims of the tragedy. So the point is, I could go on like this for a while, but the point is like, find a cause, and find a way to help, and do it. Don't just fight about who we should be blaming on social media, because I've seen so much of that just in the past 15 minutes. Even on Facebook, I almost wrote a big long two paragraphs to somebody that I at one point in time very much respected, and you know what, I just didn't. I deleted it all. I thought I was being reasonable, but you know what, is it worth it to get into a fight with someone whose mind you're not going to change? There are other ways to, let me put it this way, there are other ways to go about it. There are more productive people to fight against as a group. Anyway, so said all that, this was also the last thing I will say is, for every download that I get on the show for the next 7 days, starting Monday, which is when you're listening to this, and ending Sunday, which is June 19th, for that 7 day period, for every download I get, I will be donating $1 to these to these funds set up to help victims of and families of victims of the shootings, and for community centers there in the area. Download the episode, download this episode, download old episodes. It all goes into the same counter, if you will. It all counts. So download this episode, download all the back episodes. I'm going to be donating $1 for each one of them. I also just set this up. If you go to my website, it's dandunfordtrombone.com/podcast. I now have a donate button for the podcast, because this isn't free. I have expenses that come along with running the podcast, but if you feel, this is always going to be free. It's never going to be something that I'm charging for, but if you feel like throwing a few dollars my way, I would really appreciate it. And for the next several weeks, I would imagine I'll donate a portion of anything that comes in through there. I don't imagine it's going to be much, but anything that comes through there, I'll donate a portion of that to these these victims as well. Anyway, so this week I was very happy to sit down with the Parhelion Trio, which is a trio of three wonderful musicians, three wonderful ladies, Andrea Christie, Ashley Miller, and Sarah Carrier. It's flute, clarinet, and piano. Sarah plays the flute, Andrea plays piano, Ashley plays clarinet. They make some really great music, do a lot of commissioning. I went to school very briefly with Ashley, like 6-7 years ago now. I had a really good time talking to them. They were semi-finalists at the M competition last month. And we talked about that and, you know, how that kind of came about. I do say some snarky things about some people. I would like to emphasize that those are my snarky comments and in no way represent Parhelion Trio as a group. You know, so if you want to come after someone for being snarky, come after me, which shouldn't be that hard. Parhelion, really fun group, really good music. And on the end of the episode today, is a recording of them performing a piece called Techno Parade by Guillaume Connaissant. So I hope you enjoy that. And if you enjoy the episode, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And as of 5 or 6 days ago, the podcast is also on Google Play Music. So if you subscribe to Google Play Music, I don't know if anyone does. I think some people must, or else it wouldn't exist. But so yeah. Anyway, if you subscribe to Google Play or use Google Play, the podcast is also on there. Divergent Paths with Dan Dunford. And also let me know what you think. Shoot me an email. My email is divergentpathspod@gmail.com. Or if you know someone who might be great on the podcast, let me know. Facebook, email, whatever. Call me. I'm sure someone can give you my number. It's weird. So don't forget, for every download this next 7-day period, I'll be donating a dollar to victims of the tragedy in Orlando. So I hope that it'll be a decent amount of money that I can do. Anyway, tell someone you love them. All right, talk to you next week. After 2 weeks, the coughing from the smoking would go away, but it hasn't. It just quit.
Just 2 weeks?
Oh, wow. Yeah, congrats.
I guess. Hopefully it'll take this time. Quit before.
So quitting like cold turkey or?
That's too expensive. Like all of it's too expensive. Like vaping might be, but it's still a lot up front.
Sure.
Like for all the equipment. I'm like, you know.
Yeah.
Also, I don't want to look like a tool.
I don't know. I thought that trend would just like go away.
Yeah. Right. Totally exploded. Nope. Not going away anytime soon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw someone bust one of those out in a bar. I'm like, you are like such a tool. Like you think, oh, you could just publicly, you know.
There were some kids on they have all the flavors too, right? There were some kids that busted up on the subway and they're right beside me. I was like, oh my gosh. And you know, I couldn't wait to get off at the next stop. It was filling the car.
There's a couple, when I was still a student, there's one professor who would vape while teaching. Which I'm like, okay.
Here?
Yeah. It was great. I loved it. I thought it was really funny. But also like the funny thing is like I notice a lot of guys, musicians and like brass players, whatever, who vape. Also, like, whenever I would be outside smoking, they'd, like, bum one off of me, like, because you can vape all you want, yeah. But, like, you're still not going to get the kick from, like, actually putting poison in your lungs.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. It's so good. It's so expensive, and it kills me, but I love it. Oh, it's hard. I'm having a hard time. Anyway.
I'm glad we spent just spent 3 minutes talking about that. Parhelion Trio. Yes?
Yes.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes. We absolutely sometimes go back and forth over the pronunciation still, but
oh,
yeah,
wait,
there's
right. A controversy.
No, it's just controversy.
I can't pronounce anything.
When you hear so many people mispronounce your group's name, mm-hmm. so many times you start like questioning your own pronunciation of the group. Is it a Parhelion or a Parhelion? Well, I'm pretty sure it's Parhelion.
Okay.
We nailed it down.
Well, that's good that you actually are sure about the pronunciation of your group's name.
Recently we had someone say, is it Parhelion? Like, that would be so awesome. Like, Hellion. Like, yeah.
I was like, oh, shoot. Maybe, yeah.
Well, that's fair, I guess. What are the Hellions? They're like, anyway.
Sounds like a motorcycle gang or something.
It's much worse than that. anyway, thank you for agreeing to sit down with me. I appreciate it.
Of course, thanks for having us.
So I always do this with groups, but we're going to do like voice samples for each person. So here on the left, my left.
Hi, my name is Sarah Carrier, and I'm the flutist of Parhelion Trio.
My name is Andrea Christie, and I'm the pianist of Parhelion.
My name is Ashley Miller, and I'm the clarinetist in Parhelion.
Awesome. Hopefully that all works out. Hopefully everyone doesn't sound the same, except for me, I guess. But I'm glad we could work this out. I very briefly was a student at Manus at the same time as Ashley. Very briefly, for a year. So
it's a good year.
so good. It's funny, like people that I knew from that my very first year, like who all left. I'm starting to like play concerts with them. A lot of them again, mm-hmm. just like for money instead of for no money. instead of paying to play concerts with them, now I'm being paid to play concerts with them. It's great. It's like, oh man, I haven't played a concert with you like since like 2010. This is really cool. Anyway, so I know you guys have been together for a few years now. The origin was what year? 2000.
Well, Andrea and I. This is Sarah speaking.
It's okay. Like, you don't have to keep identifying yourself. That'll be fine.
Okay. Well, we met in 2010. We were participating at the Institute and Festival for Contemporary Performance at
here
the Manus School. Yeah, back at the old location. And we actually weren't playing in an ensemble together, but we decided that we wanted to continue playing together or to begin playing together after the festival, and we did that. And a few years ago, 2013, we mm-hmm. invited Ashley to our group, and
that's right.
Now we are complete.
That's right. It was actually a very fortuitous invite. I went to school with Sarah, and we took a class together, and that was the 20th Century Performance class. Mm-hmm.
With Ursula Oppens and Jason Eckert.
That's mm-hmm. right, yeah. And I heard Sarah play, was it Carter's mm-hmm. Flute piece? Which one did you do?
Scrivo Inventum.
Scrivo, that's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. And wow, that was just amazing. And then I said, yes.
Well, and then we played a Carter piece together.
That's right.
What is that piece called? The duo.
Rude et deux?
Yeah, yes. The one with percussion. Because there's two versions. Yeah.
It's the second one.
Mm-hmm. Second one.
Yeah. It's fun.
So if you know a lot about Carter, you'll hopefully follow that.
We all had very strong first impressions of each other's playing. I think that's what brings people together. You find mm-hmm. people who are like-minded, people you say, hey, I think I can work out something really interesting with this person. Let's see what we can explore. And
you really don't know until you start playing with each other, and then you see if it works.
And it takes a long time to figure out how to work with the intricacies of different people's playing. It just takes mm-hmm. a while, and you like even if you're like friends or like blown away, like great virtuosos don't always make for great virtuosic ensemble playing. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. obviously, each individual part can be stupendous, but when it comes to putting it together, just because you're world-renowned doesn't mean you're good at playing with others. In fact, many times, if you're a world-renowned solo-type person, you are not good at playing with others. In every sense of the word, musical and non-musical.
Right. You must bend to me all of the time.
Since we're talking about origins, what is the origin of the name? Like, I don't... I'm not sure I...
Actually, we were... it took a while to find a name, and...
You gotta find something that feels right.
And, yeah, and, you know, we were doing a lot of brainstorming, just writing down every...
We brainstormed for weeks.
Every silly thing that down came up.
Every time we would rehearse in a coffee shop and see how many names can we
come
up with.
Yeah, and I was actually Googling this group called The Phenomenon of Three, or Phenomenon of Threes, that Esther Lamnick and Keith Underwood and Martha Locker were in there, the same instrumentation as that. I was just looking for recordings. And actually, when I typed in Phenomenon of Three, the first thing that came up was the parhelion effect, which is a phenomenon involving, you know, where it appears that there's three suns on the horizon. I was like, that's a freaking awesome name.
Wait,
and,
hold on. I am not familiar with this. What is it?
So it's an atmospheric phenomenon that generally occurs in colder climates very far north. And it appears that there's three suns on the horizon.
Right, you have these two bright, little bright spots beside the sun.
That's awesome.
So it looks like three suns.
That sort of like.
And it's an atmospheric phenomenon. It's caused by the refraction of light through these crystals that are high up in the atmosphere.
Huh.
And it causes a distortion. You know, I personally haven't seen it, but as people go farther north, it's apparently much, much more common.
That's awesome.
Also called the sun dog.
Yeah,
yes.
Also called
the sun dog.
Yep. The sun dog? Sun dog.
And you didn't go with that as your name?
Well, that's our, like, alter ego name.
Yeah.
We actually have a piece
that's when you play
for
when
us.
You play rock covers, you're
yeah.
doing
yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah, yeah,
when
yeah,
sun
like,
dog.
We actually have a piece composed for us called Sun Dog.
Oh, that's cool.
So.
That works. That's cool. That makes sense. Oh, that's really cool. So which one of you is the actual sun?
I know.
Which
weird.
One's the bright one?
Oh, I always joke that it's
like
a piano because they're like an item.
Yeah.
But I mean,
well, actually on
see
stage, like Andrea is always sort of in the center.
Oh, okay.
So it kind of works.
Oh, I was hoping that there would be like more infighting over that.
Yeah.
Come on, controversy is what sells, people. So is this... The setup, the flute, clarinet, piano setup, is that a common one? Is there a lot of rep for that?
You know, it's not super unusual. Like some trios, you're like, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
But it's
yeah.
But it's not your traditional. You know, when you say piano trio, people generally assume violin, cello, and piano.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many other combinations out there. It's common enough that there are some little 19th century gems written for us. But they're a little cheesy, and there aren't so many of them out there. That was the first thing we discovered when we're like, well, what can we play? What's out there?
What? You're telling me that there's a lot of cheesy music from the 19th century? I don't believe you.
You know, I say cheesy because there are no large sonatas or
mm-hmm.
really like meaty pieces written for our combination from the 19th century. You know, a traditional trio, you know, there's Mendelssohn, there's Beethoven, they have all of this... fantastic established repertoire, and I feel like all of the pieces written for us are little miniatures,
right?
Or played,
like
they're like cute
of,
little cutesy salon pieces,
right? Like our originating piece for this instrumentation is Sanson's Tarantella,
right?
So we're working on building our app.
Well, I mean, that's like in some ways that can be really great for a ensemble starting out, because I mean, sure. Like you can start with those pieces, but you burn through them so quickly that you immediately have to be thinking
Absolutely.
Forward. You can't, you know, there are so many great, of course there are so many great string quartets, but like you can, what was the name of this quartet that just won the inaugural like big competition?
Calidor.
Yeah. And they won the supposedly new like forward-thinking artist competition by playing 150-year-old music, which I'm sure that they're an incredible string quartet.
Yeah,
we were actually there.
So I'm not taking anything away from what they're doing, but I'm using it to illustrate the point that as a string quartet, you can literally make your entire career never play anything later than 1900.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it from the Detroit Free Press. The interviewer asked them.
Mm-hmm.
If they do any contemporary music, and they're like, oh yeah, we did Webern this morning
right.
from 1909. which I thought was funny.
Cute. Well,
but all of this to say that it keeps, you have to, with a lack of music, you have to continuously be thinking forward about what you're going to do next, whether that's commissions, whether that's arranging. And it can be hard, but it also can foster like really rapid musical growth. You know, how have you approached that, you know, finding and putting together new music for yourselves?
With our friends. So we've asked a couple of friends and they've managed, you know, to come up with something for us. But we've been really honored to be working with the Flute Duo Consortium, which commissions every year a new work by a composer. This year it's Pierre Gilbert. And apparently it's being sent to us soon.
It's on the way.
It's on the way, yes.
Checks of the mouth.
And sometimes, like one of our friends will have a piece that's like almost for our combination. Like
right.
Daniel Felsenfeld had a piece that was for a flute, piano, and oboe.
Mm-hmm.
And so the oboe part we managed to make into a clarinet part. But it's a great, it's a fun piece.
High range clarinet and high range oboe are basically the same, right?
Yeah.
Same sound.
So.
Do you do your own transcriptions as well, or do you?
Andrea, yeah. You did a transcription for it.
We've dabbled in it a little, and that's what we've been talking about next. We're a little bit of a hybrid ensemble, and I think we enjoy that. We don't fit into any particular category. We're not this cookie cutter ensemble. We sort of straddle a bit of a divide. Most of our repertoire is new music, but we do because of the nature of our instruments. I mean, piano, flute, clarinet. We're in a bit of a different category, well, completely different category than, say, a percussion ensemble or a saxophone quartet where they're just looking at basically 20th century and 21st century rep. We do have some traditions to pull from and some choices to make. And there are some very beautiful sonorities in addition to all these really awesome sounds and sonorities we can get in our combination. We have done some Brahms transcriptions and arrangements of Hungarian dances.
the Debussy.
We have an arrangement of Debussy. It's not ours, but it's by Michael Webster, who's also part of a fantastic trio of the same instrumentation. And he's adapted quite a few pieces by piano forehands as well for flute, piano, and clarinet. And so that's added actually quite a bit to the body of instrumentation and repertoire for an ensemble. You've used that a little bit as a launching point, like the Debussy, that's our like traditional rep. So often we like to open a concert program with that or put it early on, and then we just branch out from that. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how suddenly a composer like Debussy that was just so cutting edge, you know, 100+, just over 100 years ago, can suddenly seem like maybe we view Bach or Beethoven today. I'm like, wow,
mm-hmm.
You know, we've really come a long way.
And a composer like Debussy wrote, you know, as a trombonist, I don't have a whole lot to draw from with older music, but he wrote so many great sonorities and pieces for the three of your instruments, while maybe not necessarily together. Mm-hmm. Like it's a musical language that fits very well for, you know, when you put the three of them together, I would imagine. Absolutely. I would imagine.
Very much.
Better than like me trying to play. It works, it's fine. It's interesting trying to find things to play on trombone. Like, there's so many pieces that I just like, and I just am like, oh, I'll play that. You guys can deal. If you don't like, if you don't like hearing a trombonist play your rep, too bad. I'm doing it. Sansong clarinet, sometimes one of my favorites.
Yep, like, I remember really like you that. Practicing.
I really like that. Anyway, so... All three of you live and play in New York, right? No? Yes?
We do,
maybe.
Yes.
We all live in different boroughs, though.
we meet in the middle.
We meet in at the Graduate Center, usually, because it's centrally located.
All the trains.
You know, I was super late today because Brooklyn was a mess.
God, I'm so glad I don't live
in
Brooklyn.
And, you know, was used and abused by the subway system today. But I got here. Took the most bizarre route, though.
This is something that is, you know, in a lot of cases, ensembles are born out of, like, school friendships, especially with traditional ensembles, school friendships, or a lot of times being in the same orchestra or in the same, you know, small region of the country. But the three of you all have, like, your own separate careers in, you know, Ashley's been working on her doctorate for the past several years, right?
Done,
you
yeah.
Fin- well,
yeah.
You were working on it for the past several years, and now you finished. Mm-hmm. And, like, everyone has their own, like, freelance stuff, teaching, et cetera, et cetera. So when it comes to finding the time to, like, still forge a musical identity in addition to everything else you're doing, like, how do you individually balance that, you know, ensemble and trying to, like, push
yeah,
forward musically.
You have to always remember to maintain yourself,
mm-hmm.
too, because it's very easy to, you know, if we're preparing for a big goal up ahead, you get used to really hashing out the same works over and over, and it's easy to get off track a little bit with your normal, like, tonal development stuff, technique, you know, just maintaining yourself. So it's something we've all had to balance.
But when you've been together for so long, you start to really identify with, you know, the unit, the parhelion, as a single entity. I mean, you sort of mesh into the same identity. And sometimes it is a struggle to develop your individual career, because I think we've all prioritized, we do other things outside, but when we look to the next seasons or next projects, we have to put parhelion a little bit above everything else. Otherwise, mm-hmm. it'll never rise to the top. There are other things that will always pop up. So it's a matter of setting, you know, we're all here for the same reason, and we'd like to see this go somewhere. What can we do to make that happen?
I was last October or November, I was speaking to one of the guys who founded Load Bang, which is fairly successful, quite successful new music group here in the city. And he was talking about, like, the idea of having to, yeah, guess what? You're going to have to turn down paying gigs to do something that doesn't pay.
Yep.
And that's
right.
How it goes. If you want,
all the
you know,
time.
You know, it's a real struggle, especially in New York. We're all struggling in some way or another. I mean, we all have to worry about where the next rent check is coming from. I know I do, at least. maybe you guys
no,
are
no,
set. it can really be easy to fall into a mindset of, you know, the most important thing is making sure I get the dollars for what I'm doing. You know, that's the number one priority. And when it comes to starting a group, that can't be the first priority. Like a great group with a great artistic vision, the priority can't be, and at least initially, and really never really, the money can't be the overarching and driving factor. It has to be the music.
We agree
yeah,
with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that does mean, you know, maybe, like, yeah, it's going to be a little tight every month, every once in a while, you know, as opposed, you know, I had to turn down this to do that, you know, because I have to do this.
Very often with concert dates, we all have three completely different work schedules where we quite frequently have to take time off to do our concerts,
mm-hmm.
and that we try to plan them far enough in advance so we can get subs for our teaching gigs or orchestra mm-hmm. jobs or wherever we're working at the time.
So, what do the three of you do individually as far as, like, all the, you know, the bulk of your, like, freelancing or teaching careers?
I think we all have some part in educating,
mm-hmm.
and I am a lecturer at St. Joseph's College in Brooklyn. I teach basically music 101, you know, like appreciation, and then I usually have some other kind of class that I teach, like, this coming semester will be History of the Symphony, and last semester was Postmodern Music. Very
Ooh.
Exciting.
That does sound exciting.
Yeah, especially when your students don't have any knowledge of music history to begin with.
Ooh, and they're just, it's like a bunch of hipsters being like, oh yeah, Postmodern sounds so great.
Right.
Oh,
right.
So I'm split in between three teaching jobs. I'm a lecturer at Adelphi University. I teach a keyboard class over there. I teach in the West Village, actually close by here, at the Greenwich House Music School,
mm-hmm.
and I also teach at a music school in Flushing called the Herald Music School. So
you spend a lot of time on the train.
Every day I'm somewhere different. And then right now we're in the middle of NISMA season. I'm also a NISMA adjudicator, so
okay.
They often want you to go upstate, I mean, several hours. I try to keep it local,
mm-hmm.
but there's always something interesting around the corner.
I teach at Hunter College and College of Staten Island. So I'm still in the CUNY system, even though I'm out of the CUNY system.
It never lets you out.
Managed
it
to
never
stay.
Lets you out.
Similar to Manus.
Seriously.
And yeah, I teach. So I teach there. I also run my own private studio of kids after school. So that's what kind of helps, you know, pay the rent and also build connections. Otherwise, just practicing and I write a lot about Charles Ives. That's what my dissertation's on, and we're trying to get some publications out of it. So.
Mm-hmm. So. As an ensemble unit, is, you know, using ensemble as a tool for education part of like what you're really shooting for, or is it? I mean, every ensemble to some extent deals with education, but mm-hmm. some are more geared towards that than others. How do you see using the trio as an educational tool in addition to like an artistic outlet?
I mean, that's something that we see us incorporating more as we progress, but I think that right now we're mainly just about creating new music for our instrumentation.
And we actually, speaking of which, it's funny you mentioned it, we did the New York Philharmonic Bridge program.
Right,
as
so
a
we have
trio,
done a little bit of outreach.
What, okay, I can't keep track of all of the Philharmonics and Carnegie, like all right. these, like, all these educational programs that are based out of, like, those two, like the whether it's the Met or the Philharmonic or Carnegie Hall, like there's so many education programs
right.
that they all just kind of like.
Right. So Ashley and I are frequently involved with the New York Philharmonic's Very Young Composers program, and so we do demos of our instruments and end of the semester concerts where we play the young composer's music. But recently, the three of us got asked to play together for the Bridge program, which is like the top kids. They're like in middle school and really, aww. Real. Well, they're impressive.
Yeah,
adorable, but very impressive.
Well, like, yeah. That's, yeah. But still adorable. I mean,
yeah, of course.
It's like those kids
yeah.
who win that win the spelling bee. Those two kids who won the spelling bee this
totally.
Year. I was just watching. God, this is going to make me sound like a 45-year-old woman. I was watching Kelly Ripa this morning while I was getting ready to leave, and they were both on there, and they're like the most adorable kids I've ever seen in my life. But anyway, point is, children geniuses. was that like a rewarding experience for you guys as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's great. These kids work really hard on their compositions. Mm-hmm. I think they have a few projects, I think, you know, in a term, and we were one of them. So we come in, and you know, often they're writing all for every group they write for. I mean, it's the first time they're writing for this instrumentation, so mm-hmm. they're exploring a lot, and they don't necessarily know exactly how it's going to come out. But you can see, it's interesting. We would play each composition twice. We play it once, and then there's a period where we get feedback. We get feedback from the composer who wrote it, from the other kids in the class, and it was really nice to see. After the first time, they were just so happy with the performance. They often have a couple little suggestions, but just to be able to get their ideas out there for us to be able to do something with it, and for them to learn and feed off of each other is just it's a fantastic experience.
Yeah, I was actually shocked by sort of the imagination of each shot. And yeah, we can't go into specific details about it, but but to sort of give an example, we played a piece and we get the music and the title of it's called Fire. And we're expecting something like super like, you know, loud or, you know, bombastic. And we start playing and it's like little flickers of like almost candlelight. And it was just amazing that, you know, they took a totally different perspective, and, mm-hmm. and they were able to explain their pieces to us.
Oh, yeah.
There was an electroacoustic piece that we played, too, where the student was inspired by some reading that he had to do for, like, that horrible state testing that all had to do. There was a poem about, like, these horses
ponies
being overworked. And
oh,
so,
no.
Yeah.
That's depressing.
And then...
Does the kid live on 57th Street?
I had to narrate, and you know, it's really quite clever.
So you spoke about like working with, you know, composers to other, like older composers to like create rep with for you, specifically for yourself. Now, recently, it's 2 months ago now, Jesus. I've been talking to Ashley about doing this for 3 months now. I can't, like, it's just like the spring has gone by so quickly. Mm-hmm. to the point where I wasn't even, like, upset that, like, not that I would be upset. I'm always grateful whenever people can come talk to me. But, like, you know, sometimes it's a little tough scheduling, and it's like, ah, oh, May, really? And then May was here. I'm like, oh, okay. I can't even be mad because I wouldn't have had time to do anything last month either. Anyway, all of that to say that, so you did, like, a, you know, National Sawdust is, like, this cool new, cool newish, it's less than, it's like a year old, right?
Yeah,
like,
less, it opened in October.
Really? Damn. So it's this cool new venue. You guys did, like, a big concert. I mean, it's... I was there for the first time, I think, like a month and a half ago. It's really weird. It's like, where did all the money come from to make this weird classical music venue? Everyone, like, it's all, it looks really expensive. Mm-hmm. Anyway, all to say, so you guys did, like, a show out there recently. So we can kind of maybe use that as an example of, like, how you put together programs for yourselves. Fair? Fair.
Sure.
So how did you, like, for, like, this is, you know, that's an important show. It's at a cool venue. So, like, how did you put together, like, the program for something like that? And how does, you know, how do you generally do things like that?
Oh, let's see. Can't even remember.
Yeah,
what
like
did.
2 months
what
ago. Like, I'm asking you to
ask. Did we start with Techno Parade?
Well, I guess to answer the programming question, I mean, we tried to pick pieces that, well, of course, for musical merit, but Daniel Felsenfeld was curating that concert, and we, of course, wanted to include him, and he narrated his own work from Maldoror.
Yeah, it's less of a specific, like, what exactly did you do for this concert, but kind of like an example.
Not like a storyline, but definitely like a flow, so it's like an experience. You know, like listening to a really great album where there's like... You know,
highs and lows. At what point we want to increase intensity? At what point do we want to chill out a little? Mm-hmm. And that we don't
give your face a rest.
Well, that's a big factor for them as well. You know, there are certain pieces that only work at the end of a half.
Hmm.
There's some right. We decided to end that program with Philip Glass Music in Fifths.
Ooh.
And for us, it was a bit of an experimentation. We'd never ended a program with that before. It has a different impact in every single space we perform. So it was a bit of a risk, but when it ended up turning out really well, it worked just fantastically for the space, and we were like, well, yeah, we need to do this more often.
Programming is such an art form that a lot of classical musicians just don't get. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you look at so many recitals, and you're like, did you even think about this?
Right.
Did you think about, like, are you just putting 40 pieces... four pieces together on a program because you can play them? Like, there's so much more to that, to everything than just...
We spend a lot of time, rehashing,
I'm a big hip-hop fan, so yeah, it's like, you have to put together a recital like someone puts together, like, a really great mixtape.
Totally.
Because otherwise, people just lose, like, it's so easy, it's a really fine tightrope walk to, like, go up to the line of pushing it too far... And then pulling people back in, it's, you know, keep them engaged, then let them, like, chill out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but always the ending a recital, like, ending on something super hype. Which for classical musicians can be Philip Glass, you know? Like, it's really, that's not written for this instrumentation, is it?
It's flexible. It's
always okay.
Flexible. Yeah.
Oh.
You know, there are two lines.
You can totally do it, trombone, sure.
So anyway, yeah, like, I mean, this, like I said, this wasn't really like a specifically what did you do for that concert, but you're kind of using that as an example of how you use your music to speak to an audience, you know?
Well, one thing we've been doing is memorizing our pieces.
What? No, don't do that. That's crazy.
Like, that's something that helps us connect more with the audience, just getting rid of the music stands and interacting more with each other.
It's been a big part of our evolution as an ensemble.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It also helps with the music making, because instead of questioning myself, is it that run? I've played it, you know, for the 765th time, but...
Are those 30-second notes right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is this the right speed? There's something about it that, you know, it's more importantly of when it's, you know, some is is going to happen. Something's coming out. But when when it happens. So by getting rid of the music stand, you know, I can actually look at Andrea's, at her arms, and, you know, I can look at Sarah's finger, and I'm like, oh, she, it's going down. It's going down.
I'm always watching my fingers. Like, it might look like she's giving me eye contact, but she's really looking at my
fingers.
She's,
like, really trying to groove. It's like,
we have a triangle of cues going on. Ashley's watching Sarah's fingers. Sarah's watching mine. I'm hopping back and forth between both of them.
So, I mean, obviously it helps with music making, but when you when you're, like, playing without, like, musical expression, like, you can tune in so much on such a deeper level to what people are saying musically, obviously, with what they're doing with their lines. But if there's also, like you're saying, like, that having that safety net there can also help with, like, super intricate passages. Like, it's hard because when things are, when it's, like, things that are intricate and, like, fitting together, like, really tightly, it can be, like, a little bit nerve-wracking to do that without, like, the safety net there.
At most definitely.
I've been asked many times, like, don't you get more anxious playing without the music? And, you know, I actually sometimes feel more anxious with the music. Namely, I had an iPad incident where the Bluetooth between my iPad and the pedal stopped working the moment before I had to go on stage. And I didn't have that piece or those pieces memorized yet. So the whole concert, I'm just, like, having a complete anxiety attack in my head. But somehow, like, it all works.
Yeah, it's funny, like... The last two recitals I've done, I've done these really complicated arrangements with like, really long... Like, the last one I did was, at like, an hour, straight-up hour of music, one piece. It's, like, an hour's... I cut, like, the Bernstein Mass down from an hour and 45 minutes down to an hour and did this huge arrangement of it. But, like, I'm dealing with, like, this huge a binder of music. Right. And, like, the page turns... to make it, like, easier to read, I did it all off, like, a piano vocal score, but it made for really difficult page turns and, like, really complicated systems. And, like, my teacher is, like, yelling at me. He's like, dude, you can't do this. Like, you're gonna screw it up in that recital. And he was kind of right. Like, when it came to it, I was just, like, super tense about making sure I set up the pages right. And, you know, and then I still fucked it up. So, you know, yeah, there's a, when it comes to that kind of thing, whether you're using an iPad, I try to only use iPads in I use iPads in rehearsal,
yeah.
or like large ensembles where it doesn't matter.
Oh, right.
Like, an orchestra concert, I'm always gonna have enough rest to just turn pages with my finger.
I was reading off of scores, so there are page turns like every 5 seconds.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the worst, but yeah.
But there's also something, you know, when you're talking about the, you know, to play with music or without music, and, you know, this idea of a safety net.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and quite honestly, if I'm put in that situation, where am I going to worry about the notes, or am I really going to worry about being with them?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, they like after what, they become your safety net.
That's right.
They really are.
Yeah, we
know each other's parts better than we ever would without memorizing.
And sometimes we jump and loop. Like, Andrea will take another exit.
One of us does something a little different, you know, one of those pieces that you have these cells that are constantly evolving, and sometimes, right, different exits, different entrances. And it's funny what the experience orally will happen. It doesn't matter which one of us does it. The other is... sometimes it's just intuitively we jump along and we realize that we've skipped a whole section, but it happened together.
And sometimes these blips are so subtle that you can't even hear them in recordings.
Yeah.
I know that happens a lot.
Nine times out of ten, well, actually I would say 99 times out of 100, the people in the audience, especially with you guys, like, they're not going to know the music ahead of time. Maybe one of the transcriptions they might know, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But they're probably not going to know the piece. And if it sounds good and you make a great musical statement, it doesn't matter when it comes down to it. I mean, it matters. It matters, but does it matter?
No, we're definitely not. I mean, I don't know. Are we perfectionists? Or are we kind of are, but
are,
like,
you perfectionists or are you musicians?
Like,
that's the
you
real
know,
question.
There we go.
That's a whole other kind
of
worms.
we can, you know, let go of the fact that things aren't always going to be perfect, but I think we strive...
Of course.
Pretty far.
You want to strive for that perfect musical statement, but sometimes the greatest musical statements come out of imperfection.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
whether that's because of like a sudden burst of energy, nervous, adrenaline energy, you might get something crazy out of something that you would never have gotten had you just played everything perfectly. So as a unit, like, you guys have background, obviously, you know, are your backgrounds individually in chamber music or more like in a solo orchestral sense? Obviously piano works differently. It just does. I mean, there are pianists who specialize in playing orchestral right. music, because that does come up a bit. How has your focus shifted from those original like viewpoints in coming to create a totally different type of sound? You know, what are the challenges that you've faced and that kind of a deal. So all the questions, like, there's so many ways you could go, and I'll be happy with any of them.
Well, I moved to New York from Southern California, knowing that I wanted to study with Robert Dick, and I ended up doing my master's and my doctorate studying with him. And, you know, so I was really focused on soloistic flute playing, exploring extended techniques. And I was also very much looking for more chamber music experience. Previously, I was really more of a classical flutist. You know, I had all the orchestral excerpts memorized, and I was sort of on that track. But, you know, then
Are you going to practice one? Like, all of them.
All it took was hearing, you know, one of Robert Dick's albums and realizing how much sound possibilities are out there. And
there's more than orchestral playing. It's crazy.
I mean, it's funny, when I was in North Carolina growing up, I went to North Carolina School of the Arts, and I was like,
oh, you're one of those.
Oh,
people.
Yeah, totally. But, you know, I was a soloist. Mm-hmm. I, you know, played North Carolina Symphony. I was touring around, and, you know, solo was sort of my thing. I was on From the Top, you know, doing Brahms. I mean, it was just...
What year were you on From the Top?
Oh, man. 2006.
Like, there's like a 98% chance that I heard you play, because I listened to that thing. My parents made me listen to that every week. Let's put it that way. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah, so, you know, it was funny, because I came to New York, and I was like, you know, solo would be great. And then I met some really fantastic soloists from all over the world, and, you know, some good friends of mine who study with Charles Nandich, who I study with. And, you know, I was just sort of amazed, but I was really amazed at what the clarinet could do that I'd never been exposed to in really contemporary music, and how, you know, the clarinet can make really cool effects and sounds, and it doesn't always have to be in the box. And I love playing in orchestras for quite some time, but then I found out I didn't like to be told really how to play my line every single time I opened up and let expression take over. And so I don't know, I guess once I hit the doctoral path, I had finished at MANA, so I was no longer playing in the MANA's orchestra and New York Youth Symphony. You know, I was no longer doing any of that. And it gets lonely, and you can always play solo stuff, and you'll always be, you know, by yourself, and you feel that you've made a statement, but there's something about having that collaboration that's really valuable. It gives meaning, and it, I don't know, it gives you a sense of perspective of where you are and where to grow. I tell you, I grow so much from Sarah and Andrea, you know, just playing with them and seeing what they're doing. And Sarah will take a phrase, we will have the same thing, we'll have totally different interpretations, we'll argue for 5 minutes, and then we'll decide. And you know, but that's one thing I really like about our group is we all have very different backgrounds, and we're very different people. Yet we find common ground, and it's that process that is really valuable, and I think that's where, you know, we grow the most.
Right. I like that in a trio we all bring our different experiences and our experiences as soloists and also chamber musicians to the table. I also, like Ashley, began thinking, you know, with the mindset of a soloist. I went to college thinking I'm going to be a concert pianist, I'll play lots of concertos, I'll do some chamber music. And it's really interesting that the more you're exposed to, the more you realize You know, like what Ashley emphasized, first of all, it can be a little lonely. Yeah. Being in a practice room with your piano for so many hours a day. But
I mean, you're going to do that regardless.
And you know, as a trio, we spend so much of our... I spend half my time playing with them. You know, it really changes the balance in the practice in the studio. You're not spending, you know, 90% of your day alone. You're spending half your day working out some of the issues that you've discovered on your own, but then seeing, you know, how does this work in the ensemble? And I can't say how much, you know, it's difficult to express to the, you know, to the degree that how enjoyable it is and how much you grow from that. It's just on a different level than working by yourself all the time. You're exposed to so many new ideas and so many different ways of thinking about a particular musical problem.
It's, and, you know, you think about, like, soloists, piano, concert solo, piano soloist, instrumental soloist. I remember, I was reading a biography of Van Cliburn from, I don't know, this was like 10 years ago I was reading this. And, you know, every solo season or whatever, a pianist will, like, you know, you might know, there's hundreds and hundreds of piano concertos, far more concertos than are for any other instrument, which is great, you have a lot to choose from. But because of that, like, almost everything you've done, or you'll be doing, has been done before, hundreds of times, better or worse, whatever it is. But even so, like, these soloists, they'll have, you know, they might know all of these concertos, but every season, you're spending all of your time with, like, three, four, five, maybe, you know, the same five concertos, and then you spend a year, full, straight up a year, 2 years of your life, just performing these four pieces with different orchestras, whether, you know, touring around. And that's just, I mean, come on, like, how many times are you going to do Rachmaninoff 2 before you want to murder someone or yourself? Like, that's pretty dark, but I mean, and some people love it, and people are always going to get up for those pieces. People are always going to be stoked for another performance of the Emperor Concerto, like, come on, man. Or the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. I mean, come on, Copeland, whatever. Like, whatever it is, like, people are generally going to be up for that. But as a performer, like it seems like that would eventually stunt your musical growth. Whether, you know, and of course, that's not to say anything poor about any soloist, because they're really great at what they do. But just from a musical growth standpoint, at some point, like, don't you have to, for your own sanity, have to branch out from that, you know? Anyway, that was a long monologue by me, so, but I can do that because it's my show. But then I run into the problems of talking myself into a corner and not knowing how to get out of it.
Well, you do have to make a negotiation as a performer. How much are you playing for yourself, and how much are you playing for your audience? Because you want to encourage people to come back. So I think we do a pretty good job of balancing our program so that there's a little bit of something for people who may not normally go to classical music concerts at all, but also throw in a couple of unusual tastes, you know, just little sprinklings of things that they might normally not come for.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and we like to also incorporate pieces that are by our friends, because they often come, and we can introduce them, and, you know, to someone who's not an avid concert goer, to meet a real living composer and hear their work, you know, it's...
And it's such a, nice. You know, the community musicians in New York can be such just like a fun group of people to be a part of, and just like playing with your friends, playing your friends' music, because there's so many talented people. And so many people who deserve more money than they make, I'm sure. You know what I mean? So it's just like a real fun thing to be able to do, to have access. You know, each one of us knows dozens of composers that we could, if they have the time, and we or I have the money, can we can, like, do something, you know? And it's really rewarding to do that, and there's not very many places where you have that opportunity. If I was in Augusta, like, what was, like, what would I do? Like, nothing. Work at a Barnes & Noble, probably. Play one concert a year. So, you know, you do have to, because the audience, they're the consumer, right? So you do have to give the consumer what they paid for. In some, I mean, that's a very capitalistic way to look at an art form, which doesn't always bode well for the art form. But when it comes down to it, you want people to come back. So, like, and new music, for all its wonders, and can be prickly.
We've all been to concerts where the performers, you know, even as someone who plays a lot of new music, you know, like, the performers are maybe really just playing for themselves.
And that's not, there's not necessarily a problem with that.
I know, but it's nice to feel invited.
Yes. You know, it really, especially if you're paying money.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm paying $25 to see someone play, I'm like, throw me a bone.
Yeah, like, we've all been a captive audience. It's not fun.
I don't, it sounded like you were saying captive in a bad way. Like,
what did I mean?
Yeah, so how do you like look at, you know, could, but at the same time, there's nothing wrong with playing pieces for yourself, like, of performing course. Pieces for yourself.
We always do.
I think there's definitely a balance to be struck there, because I think we all three of us strongly feel that if we are very passionate about what we do, we feel that will always be communicated to the audience, and then if we were to put together an entire program just based on what we think people want, I don't think that would be as effective as doing things that we're passionate about. We're going to put all our 110% of ourselves into, and then figure out at that stage, you know, how do we interact with the audience with what we've created, and how can we bring both sides together?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we're talking about aesthetics, cause that's kind of what we're looking at. You present a diverse program. Someone's going to love this piece, hate this piece. Someone's going to love the piece they hated, and then, you know, it's a toss up. In many ways. So yeah, I think what Andrew is saying is right. You know, we have a passion. We've created this idea, this program, this not program in the sense of there's a storyline, but a program in a sense there's an idea and inspiration for what we're trying to go towards and project. And, you know, as long as we stay true to that, you know, we could argue that the audience did get what they paid for if we played the best of our abilities.
Sometimes we're surprised the piece that we think is the strangest one, or like the one that's not gonna go down as well, is the one that everyone comes up to us afterwards like, oh, that was awesome. Yeah. I love that. So,
well, you know, when it comes like down to what you're selling on stage, like, yeah, the music is important, but you're also selling yourselves as, and saying, this is what I believe in, mm-hmm. and here's why you should care. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, like, it could be the weirdest off the wall. If you do it right, like, the weirdest off the wall, most difficult to stomach sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The most difficult piece can become accessible to even the most, and I don't say this in a pejorative sense, but the most uneducated listener. Mm-hmm. They can still access it because of how you're presenting it, as opposed to just going to a concert where they're like, someone like is throwing stuff at a wall, right. And is like, I don't care if you like it or not, here it is.
Well, we saw we already mentioned the M-Prize finals. We saw the Yarnwire.
M-Prize, right. Yes. Yeah, Yarnwire. M-Prize. They're like the crazy percussion group, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that are like super dope.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They're amazing. They're amazing. But it kind of goes to that. I'll never forget that the first piece they played, they actually, they had some buzzing stuff go on, but at one point, they all just hit a note. And it was just, was it a note? Was it really pitched? And you just sit, and it kind of just sat there. And it was just one attack. And it was so amazing, because you knew that they had thought out how long it was going to resonate, how they wanted it to sparkle. So it wasn't just the attack being immaculately together, but it was allowing it to ring, not moving. And it was something so simple. And so, I don't know, it gave it such...
But it was how they performed it. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't... It could have just sounded like a regular old downbeat, or it could have visually looked like a downbeat, but instead it looked like it came from like a horizontal. It was really hard to explain what I mean, but it was just like they felt it in their bodies and we're not counting, which of course that would be really, you know, not as effective if...
It comes from a more organic, mm-hmm. emotional place than from a, this is where the note goes, and this is where the snow goes, and this is how long it lasts, and this is how music mm-hmm. is. Autograph. But, well, not a literal graph, even though that does exist, but...
Yeah, the Empire, so that was a crazy experience.
Well, and... We were semi-finalists, so...
Yeah.
I didn't realize that you were taking part in that competition. That's like something I should have known.
No worries. It was a great experience. We met a lot of people, and yeah. we...
So, oh, man. Amazing. You see, that would have been a good thing. You know what it was? I think one of the three of you... I'm not friends with you on Facebook, but one of you shared something about the Emprise. I think that's where I've just pulled all of that information from earlier. Maybe I might be wrong, but that makes more sense as to why you would share stuff about that. But okay, so like now that's come up, let's shift like towards that. Sure. You're semi-finalists, so that's what the final 4, 6, 8. How many?
Well, there's 3 categories. There's the strings, the winds, and the open category.
And you're in the open category.
Actually, we were in the winds category. Oh. They allow piano.
Oh.
Yeah.
There I guess. No, I'm just kidding.
So yeah, I mean, competitions are always such a weird thing. You know, you go there, you present what you do, and you can never expect a certain outcome because there are just an infinite number of factors that go into the decisions, mm-hmm. and you know, what kind of space you're going to play in, you know. Mm-hmm. Our category had, out of the 7 groups, 4 were saxophone quartet. There was us, there was a woodwind quintet, and there was a brass quintet.
Yes.
Well, I mean, if you're a classical saxophone player, you have to find some reason to get up in the morning.
Exactly.
Quartets are one of those very few reasons. Right. It's horrible. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. there were... sorry, what were you going to say, Ashley?
Yeah, and they picked the 3. So 2 saxophone quartets and the brass.
Yeah, they picked, for the final round, they picked 2 saxophone and 1 brass. And they... You know, the saxophones already had more than a 50% chance of showing up to the finals. This is interesting. The space we played in, you know, was a little dry.
But
it was a learning experience, you know, to play in any acoustical environment. But you know, it was awesome. There are so many New York groups there. Not a big surprise. Yeah. But you know, it was like a reunion in some ways.
It was nice.
And it was really nice. The New York people are always like, you know, we know we could run into each other the next day. So everyone's really cool and, you know, not about outstaging each other, you know, because all you could do is really do your thing when it's your turn.
It was a great opportunity to see so many amazing, amazing ensembles all in one place in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a little unfortunate that it had to be so, everything had to be so close together. The finals round happened over a 2.5-hour window on the last day of the competition, where they were mm-hmm. running the strings finalists, the open finalists, and the winds finalists all at the same time. And so you had to kind of pick and choose. So we didn't always watch the same groups. Mm-hmm. In that final day, I went to watch all the open groups, basically, and you know, 2 of them were from mm-hmm. New York.
And we saw 1 open group.
Yeah, we all saw the Foundry together.
The Foundry, another New York-based group. And then we went and caught the saxophone quartets.
Yep.
In the wind division. Mm-hmm. Just to see.
Yes.
Just to see.
It's phenomenal.
See, what's so fucking great about these bitches? So that's me saying that that's not
that is
any,
no way representative.
That's no way representative of how the Parhelion Trio. I'm okay with being blacklisted by everyone, so I'll just like insult people. So you make the semifinals, you know, you don't get maybe what you were hoping to get out of it. Monetarily. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like maybe not. But what do you take away from something like that?
We took away many things from this. Yeah. First of all, what I like the openness of this competition. One of the things they emphasized is that this wasn't your obviously for the monetary amounts being awarded, they had, what was it, over $200,000 in prizes.
Right.
But aside from that, they emphasized, look, this isn't your regular competition. We encourage, once you're out of the competition, if you don't advance to the next round, or when it's either then or when it's over, that you communicate with your jury panel, that you ask them for feedback, that you speak to them, that you network and make those contacts. And that's something that most competitions, they certainly don't mention, and sometimes they would prefer that you not do. Mm-hmm. So we took full advantage of that, and we got great feedback.
Well, they actually let you talk to the judges right after you're disqualified. So that night, we took it for, you know, what it was. But that night, there was an event at the art museum on campus at the University of Michigan. They had a beautiful spread of food. They treated us, I gotta say, they treated us really well for the whole competition. And we got to approach the judges and look them in the eye and ask them for feedback, which is pretty cool.
So why do you
hate
me?
They were very generous.
Yes, of course.
And very helpful. You know, they thought of things that we weren't really thinking about.
And that we hadn't considered before as well.
Considered before, yeah.
They also had suggestions as to, you know, where to go from here and things to look out for.
Repertoire.
And, yeah.
Ways to prepare. You know, for the next one.
Also, yeah. I think one of the best feedback we got from multiple judges are how to, you know, when you're in acoustics that aren't to your advantage for your ensemble, how to compensate for that, and different ways you can approach that.
Yeah. That's going to help us outside of like future competitions. We're not a competition group, I think a lot of these groups that participate are not. Some of them were, for sure, already won things, and that's what they do. But a lot of these groups are just here for, you know, this.
It's a weird thing because competitions are a really great way to get funding for things that you might want to do, or a record deal, or a
management.
Notoriety. what's the other one? Just like getting your name out there so people know who you are. But it also kind of fosters a weird thing in among musicians,
right?
Because music can be like a sport, but it's not really a sport. Mm-hmm. But
it is a bit of an odd feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's well, I guess audition culture is the same way.
It's like we're all winners, but we're not all winners.
I'm a big basketball fan, so I was watching last night was the last game of the Eastern Conference Finals, blah blah, it doesn't matter. But the point is the Oklahoma City Thunder were up in the 7-game series 3-1. Like, they only needed one more win to go to the finals, and they ended up losing the series. The other team won 3 straight games to beat them. But someone tweeted out afterwards, and they came really, really close to winning. Someone tweeted out after the game last night that, like, the moral of this story, kids, is that you can work your ass off and play the best you've ever played, and someone who's better is just going to beat you, and your life is trash. I read that, and I was like, what up, audition culture? Yeah. Hello, how are you?
Well, the really weird thing about this particular competition is in the end, in the grand finals, you have 3 completely different categories competing against each other. Mm-hmm. In the end, it was Yarn Wire, and for those of you who don't know what that group consists of, it's 2 percussion, 2 piano, a string quartet, and then a saxophone quartet. So what if each group plays objectively at the exact same level?
Yeah.
Then do you pick?
You pick the string quartet. That's what happens. Hey, we're a giant open competition for new ensembles, but we're gonna pick the string quartet for the money. That's me being snarky and bitter. Sorry, M Prize. I don't hate you. You're just
no. We love M Prize, but it was just great. Something I was kind of thinking.
Yeah, it's
about.
Like it's really hard to like when you're looking at. Sure, if you're in an audition situation, you're looking at 15 different clarinet players for a job. There are ways to whittle that down, even with the very best. When it comes down to it, you can pick someone who, I mean, in an ideal merit-based world, like, yeah, you can go with whoever's, you know, best sound, best whatever, best fit for this orchestra. But in a thing like that, if you're objectively playing at the same level, like, how, you know, it comes down to personal taste. And that's kind of a bummer of a thing to base base the competition off of. Not that I would know, because I'm sure there was someone who was, but I don't know. Anyway, that's I'm gonna get off that horse. anyway, so what do you guys have coming up in the next several months?
This summer, into the fall, we are getting down and dirty and working on improvisation and arranging.
Yes.
Hell yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Intensive.
Yes. Yeah. So, doing all that stuff that we normally have to kind of put to the side during our crazy busy school years. Mm-hmm. And just breaking everything down to, you know,
what's a great
here's a note, now you play.
When you, yeah. If you do a lot of teaching, summer's a great time to be able to like look at things that you really, directions you really want to go in,
it really is.
And start adding that to what you do. And improvisation, especially with the new music culture and the way it's going, like improvisation has become a linchpin for classical musicians who never thought they would have to improvise. Now, it's not over changes necessarily, but it's still like a whole can of worms that no one told us we would have to do. Thanks, music school. That's right. Man, can you tell I'm really against the musical establishment? Like, I'm just like going off. It's crazy. It should be less snarky.
Well, I actually did a lot of improvisation through a musical establishment.
Fair enough.
NYU. That's where I got introduced.
NYU's weird.
Steinhardt's
a weird conservatory. Like, I can never figure out.
There's like two different music schools at NYU.
Yeah, it's I have opinions, but I will leave those off. Because who cares? No one cares about my opinion. So I'm working towards like concerts for the fall and that kind of deal. Like,
contracts are in the works.
We have a couple contracts in the works. Nothing we can say anything about.
Oh, yeah. Great. So, no, please tell me more about the things you can't talk about. I'll just hold
what
this.
What we can say for sure is that we are working on incorporating at least one improvisation per concert.
Nice. Mm-hmm. That's not exciting. I want to hear the stuff you can't tell. I'm just kidding. That's awesome. As far as finding more about your ensemble, you can find them on Facebook.
Yes,
yeah.
On Facebook.
Parhelion is Parhelion. Yeah. For those of you who can't spell.
We have a website, parheliontrio.com. Mm-hmm.
Dope. And
also a Twitter page.
But here's the deal. Do you guys have Instagram?
I can't remember.
We had not one.
Man, that's like,
I think we do, but you know, it's hard to manage my own Instagram.
I know.
And the group Instagram.
That's the thing. Like, I've started doing like all my podcast stuff on my own personal Instagram, and it's just a hassle. But it's like, Instagram is so good, especially for musicians. It's so good. Because like with this like the hashtagging, you can connect with musicians on in like LA or internationally, and of course a lot of weird sex bots, but but mostly musicians. It's a hassle, but it's so worth it. And I guess supposedly that's what I'm told. It's supposedly worth it. Anyway,
and check out our videos on YouTube. We have our own channel. We have lots of videos up.
Yeah, we do. Please check out our videos.
Great. Guys, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having us, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.